Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from the September 2021 edition of True West Magazine. The articles that I'll be reading are related to photography. The photographers who, for history, captured those images of that time and that place, and also of some of the techniques and styles that they used. Edward S. Curtis Redeemed by Bob Bowes Bell. An underdog gets his due. All my life, I have heard criticism of Edward Sheriff Curtis. He faked his photos. He didn't do this. He had no business doing that. Here's how Curtis described his life's mission. I want to make them, American Indians, live forever. It's such a big dream, I can't see it all. The passing of every old man or woman means the passing of some tradition, some knowledge of sacred rites possessed by no other. Consequently, the information that is to be gathered for the benefit of future generations, respecting the mode of life of one of the great races of mankind, must be collected at once, or the opportunity will be lost for all time. Yes, and the dream ended up being so big it broke him financially. It ruined his marriage, and it almost killed him physically. Still, he endured. It took him 30 years to finish, and in the end, he never made a dime out of the finished product. And yet, the end results speak for themselves. In this issue, you will bear witness to a stunning record of a people who deserve to be remembered as righteous and proud. Thank you, Edward Sheriff Curtis. We love you, and hopefully in this special collector's issue, we have proved it. Our cover boy, Weasel Tail Pygon, is part of a wonderful new exhibition at Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West. Light and Legacy, The Art and Techniques of Edward S. Curtis, opens on October 19, 2021. It is a stunning collection and includes audio recordings, photographs, and even early motion pictures. We are here to tell you it's part of the reason we named the Scottsdale Museum of the West our top museum of 2021. A special shout out to Mike Fox, Trisha Losher, James Ballaristri, and the gang down at Western Spirit for making this a spectacular issue. The Last Frontier, Edward Curtis's Final Adventure, by James D. Ballaristri. What we know. He was 59. He had a bad hip after a whale upended his boat while he was making a film. He would travel to Alaska with his daughter Beth, a first for both of them, and something that pleased him greatly. What he knew. He knew this would be the last chapter in the adventure of the North American Indian, that the photographs he took, the languages and stories he set down, would comprise the 20th and final volume in the series. He knew that he would not be able to circle back to Alaska again, as he had done with the Hopis, where only patience and persistence after years of visits earned him a place in the Kiva and in the sacred snake dance. What we don't know. Even from the pages of the diary he kept, we don't know whether or not he took the Alaskan adventure as an opportunity to look back over his life, his travels, trials, travails, and triumphs. What he didn't know. He didn't know that this would be the final adventure of his life. To the very end of his days, he expected that there would be other journeys. He also didn't know that on his return from Alaska, when he arrived in Seattle, the sheriff's deputies would be there to arrest him at the behest of his ex-wife, Clara, for non-payment of alimony, and that he would be subjected to a humiliating, very public set of hearings. At those hearings, he would describe his avocation, his passion, and his single-minded drive to achieve it. The man was Edward S. Curtis. The month was October 1927. In June of that year, Curtis, Beth, and a college student named Eastwood, who had proven himself game on Curtis's last trip to Oklahoma, sailed from Seattle to Nome. They sailed past the place in British Columbia where Curtis had made the first all-Indigenous film, one that Hollywood had ginned up with the preposterous title In the Land of the Headhunters. The film had been a critic's darling and a box office dud, and had cost Curtis dearly, even more if you count his whale-smashed ship. Before that, back in 1899, Curtis had been the official photographer on an Alaskan expedition organized by railroad robber Baron E. H. Harriman. The ship they took was well-stocked with the following: milk cows, a grand piano, good champagne, better whiskey, I'm guessing about the whiskey, and top-notch naturalists, including John Muir, John Barrows, Gifford Pinchot, and George Bird Grinnell, whose observations of abandoned native villages on their journey led him to invite Curtis to accompany him to Blackfoot Country. Grinnell felt that the indigenous peoples of the Americas were a noble but vanishing race, and that it would be a race to record their likenesses, languages, ceremonies, and customs, for they were sure to die out before another century passed. From our vantage point, it seems that in the minds of these naturalists and anthropologists, the buffalo, the wilderness, and the Indian became entangled. It is strange that these men labored to save the buffalo and set aside some wilderness, but thought that the primitive Native American was doomed to extinction by the pressures of modernity and Western civilization. Nevertheless, from these men and their contemporaries was born the myth that fired Curtis's imagination and caused him first to neglect and then to forget the thriving portrait business he had built in Seattle, where he had a name and reputation, where he could have amassed a small fortune and lived quite comfortably with his family, taking artful pictures of brides, debutantes, and captains of industry. Comfort was something Curtis rarely knew after 1899. Nome was the first stop in Alaska in 1927. A gold rush boomtown in 1899, it was spectral now, played out, derelict, an emblem of the rise and fall of empires. Curtis had felt firsthand the sting of the metaphor of the rise and fall. He had received the blessing of Theodore Roosevelt and had been backed by J.P. Morgan. He had been one of the toasts of New York. He wrote in a 1949 letter to Seattle librarian Harriet Litch, "Some winters where we," Curtis and Buffalo Bill Cody, "were both in New York, we palled about a bit and were dubbed the Cody Twins." Since its inception in 1900, however, Curtis had sunk every penny into the North American Indian, rarely drawing pay for himself or his family. Not long after the publication of Volume 20, the Alaska Volume, Curtis signed over all the rights to the Morgan heirs and went to live near his daughter Beth in Los Angeles. He continued to dream big dreams of the history he would write that he would call The Lure of Gold, and of a last great trek to the Amazon. On July 10, 1927, the Curtis party reached Nunavik Island. Curtis was thrilled because while there had been Russian and American visitors to the island, there had been no proselytizing. So the stories and ceremonies and the Yupik dialect spoken there went on unchecked by Christianity. Should any misguided missionary start for this island, Curtis wrote, enlisting the natural world as his ally, I trust the sea will do its duty. Yupik tales and masks made their way to the surrealists in New York and France, as recent exhibitions at the Heard Museum and elsewhere have revealed, and they exerted a powerful influence on the late work of Henri Matisse. Curtis revealed in Nunavik artistry and in the fact that these people smiled broadly and often, as opposed to most of the Native Americans he had photographed. To him, Nunavik was sufficient unto itself. her people skilled at making kayaks and sewing skin coats and hunting caribou on land and whales at sea. They fought and celebrated life on their own terms, from within their own cultural traditions, not on the terms of settlers or missionaries. Look, for example, at the portrait of the young Nunavik woman, Kinuan. Her aspect is confident, curious, exuberant. Her beaded piercings are nothing short of stylish. She seems entirely herself. One wonders whether, at the time he took this photograph, Curtis's notion of the vanishing race might not have trembled, even crumbled at the edges. In fact, if I am correct, Kinuan had been photographed by Alaskan warden W.B. Miller 2 years earlier. In that photo, she stands by the wheel of a ship holding a child. Vanishing? Hardly. The dwellings on stilts Curtis scaled to explore, defying his whale-smashed hip, on King Island, circled him back to the pueblos of the Southwest. The place was deserted. As Timothy Egan wrote in his Curtis biography, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, everyone was away, Curtis surmised, and would take up residence only during the peak of the walrus migration. Curtis himself wrote, "The village is like no other on the continent. These people may well be called the North Sea Cliff Dwellers." Curtis, who devoted himself to evidence, makes no explicit connection between the peoples of the Arctic and of the Southwest, but leaves it to the reader to speculate on cultural transmission over time and across a continent. An image of Curtis's vessel, the Jewel Guard, floating in front of the village, clinging to the cliff, seems an apt metaphor for the fragility of the artists and all human endeavor. Curtis would get as far as Little Diomede Island, just this side of the international date line in the Bering Sea, and within hailing distance of Big Diomede Island, the easternmost extremity of the Soviet Union. Looking for natives who had been least affected by European settlement had led Curtis to these remote and inhospitable islands. Perhaps instinctively, he had ended his journey by circling back in time to the places where the first peoples had crossed to the American continent from Asia, whether by land bridge or by boat, is a current matter of debate. After an ice storm nearly sank his boat on their return to Nome and their arrival had been delayed, Curtis was declared lost at sea. But when reports of his demise turned out to be greatly exaggerated yet again, this was the second time Curtis had been deemed dead, Clara saw the news of his resurrection. She no doubt saw it as honorary unkillability, and called in the sheriff, which is where we came in. If it hadn't been the North American Indian, Edward Curtis would have heard some other calling, something to complete that could never be completed, something to perfect that could never be perfected. He would have found a hip-smashing white whale to play Ahab opposite. That's who he was. Envisioning Curtis's response to those who asked how he did it, Egan summarizes the complexity and sheer impossibility of the task Curtis set for himself, writing, "You had to understand the essence of a thing before you could ever hope to capture its true self." And yes, he was trying to bring a painterly eye to the process, a subjective artistry. No two people could point a camera at something and come away with the same image. But of course, photography involved a mechanical side as well, and there, too, you could shape the final product to match a vision, to bring the right image to light from a stew of chemicals, to touch it up in a print shop, to finish with an engraving pen. Curtis never turned it off, never took time to play or let his mind roam, even at home. At the trial, Curtis broke down, as if the sacrifice his passion had required had flooded over and through him, and said, "It was my job, the only thing I could do that was worth doing." The cultures of indigenous Americans today are thriving and growing as they assert their voices in politics and the arts and lay claim to their lands, rights, and languages. Curtis's work in indigenous linguistics has been of assistance in this. Buffalo continue to roam, though not exactly wherever they may like. Wilderness, however, is a beleaguered, circumscribed thing. Edward Curtis in 2021 might find himself going back to his beginnings, leading tours to Mount Rainier, and aligning himself with Sir David Attenborough, filming retreating glaciers and endangered species. One of the Nunavak stories recorded in Volume 20 begins, "There was a time, long ago, when a man all at once became conscious of himself. From consciousness, the man ventures out into the world to complete and fulfill himself. I find myself feeling great empathy for Curtis. I, too, am 59. I haven't led the life he has, but I have led a life that, like his, has sometimes led me. The sheriff's deputies aren't waiting for me, not so far, but I do circle back to the turns I made and didn't make, as I am sure he did when he sat before the judge in that courtroom. Yet I wake every day, as I know Edward Curtis did, with the feeling that I have one more adventure in me, one more. And then I say to myself, sometimes even out loud, at least one." End of text. And now, since these stories in particular lean so much toward the photography, I'm going to go back and try to shortly describe the photographs that are on this webpage with this particular article. The first photograph is of a woman and a child. The child is on the woman's back, and they are both bundled up very warmly in homemade garments. They even have parkas around their heads. Caption accompanying photograph: "Photographed against a textured textile background, woman and child, capitalized, reveals Edward Curtis as a restless artist, one who scoured images of old master portraits for inspiration. Curtis sought to present the inner lives of his subjects and transport viewers beyond ethnography. Courtesy Library of Congress." The next photograph is of a Native American man. This photograph is fairly close up. We see to the top of his forehead and then to the bottom, about the middle of his chest. He is also wrapped very warmly and is wearing a parka. Caption accompanying photograph: "Native interpreters were essential to Curtis's ambitious project. Indeed, he could not have achieved a fraction of his projects without them. Curtis was disappointed to find missionaries at Katsubi who opposed his interest in traditional culture." All images courtesy Charles Deering McCormick Library of Special Collections, Northwestern University, unless otherwise noted. Our next photograph is of a Native American woman. The camera is just slightly above her. She's looking slightly up at the camera, and her head is parted in the middle with her hair. She is wearing some kind of a nose ring, and it looks like there are the little beads that are within the nose ring. Also, she is wearing some dangly earrings that are obviously homemade, and they are matching a dangling types of fabric that are from her lower lip. She is bundled up in, it could be a parka, but the parka is not on her head. Caption accompanying photograph: "We know the exposure times on the cameras Curtis used were not instantaneous, and that he spent hours in the darkroom getting his prints right. Yet somehow he managed to grasp Kinawan's spontaneity and charm as if this were a quick snapshot." And indeed, the photo, I neglected to mention that the woman in the photo, who it turns out is the woman mentioned in the article, Kinawan, she is smiling very, very greatly. Our next photograph is of a man. He is older. He looks a little bit weathered. His face is certainly weathered. He has a short mustache and some stubble around his chin and mouth area. His hair is very tousled and is salt and pepper. He's wearing a jacket, which includes a parka, but the parka is not pulled up. Caption accompanying photograph. Curtis captured the weathered face of an experienced Bering Sea hunter in Cape Prince of Wales Man, not long after he went to Little Dawneed Island, within hailing distance of the Soviet Union. Image courtesy Library of Congress. The following photograph is of a family. It looks like we have four individuals in this family. They are sitting on some rocks. They are, again, dressed warmly. Some have their parkas on their heads and some are not. These look like they are children, in fact, although there could be an adult in the middle. But we do have four people here. Caption accompanying photograph. The father of four often found himself far from family. For the Alaska trip, however, Curtis's daughter Beth accompanied him and saw how happy he was working among the people of the island of Nunavak, where this photograph was taken. Our next photo is taken on the sea. We are looking at a small kayak, and two men are in the kayak. They're holding their oars. This is to the side. We're looking toward the side of this image of them, and they are wearing parkas. Caption accompanying photograph. Curtis described at length the ingenuity and artistry in the construction of kayaks and their use as transportation and hunting crafts. Courtesy, Library of Congress. The following photograph is also of a boat, but it's a much bigger boat than a kayak. It could fit several people, and it looks like it's a fairly deep boat as well. It looks like we have four people on the left side that are nearest to us, and then on the right side of the boat, on the other side, there are four other people as well, and they appear to be pushing the boat from the beach and into the sea. Caption accompanying photograph. Looking at launching the whaleboat, one ponders whether Curtis ever paused long enough to consider how a boy from Whitewater, Wisconsin, found himself at the top of the world at the end of a long and wild road. Courtesy Library of Congress. The next photo is another boat, and we're looking at it. We're looking at it from the water. The vantage point, we are in the water, and we can see land, cliffs behind this boat. This is actually, it looks like a professionally built craft. It has the words Jewel Guard on the side of the boat. It's named. It has two tall masts. Curtis's boat, the Jewel Guard, posed in front of a precarious King Island village, despite being run aground, befogged, coated in ice, and traversing the icy Bering Sea, she saw the party through, only to be wrecked beyond salvage just a few years later. And it looks like we have one more photo. This again is a photo. It's a close-up of a man wearing a parka. He has a mustache, a goatee, and we see just a little bit of the hair at the top of his head where the parka comes to that side at the top of his head. It looks like he is mainly gray with some little flecks of darker hair among that. And he's kind of squinting into the camera. And again, sort of a weather-beaten face. Caption accompanying photograph. While including ethnographic details, Quinaru's sewn coat and fur-lined hood, Curtis caught the quizzical visage of a hunter whose eyes reveal a life spent scanning the horizon for signs of quarry. Our next article, Have Camera, Will Travel, True West 2021, by Jeremy Rowe. The Fearless Mirror Makers of the Arizona Territory. Arizona and the Southwest were virtually unknown in the middle of the 19th century. A few publications describe travel across the area after the Mexican War and the area defined by the Gadsden Purchase as entrepreneurs flooded into California for the gold rush. Artist Henry Cheever Pratt's sketches of the area appeared in the Bartlett Survey Report between the images of markers that were raised to demark the new border. Some showed the barren landscape and images of the survey party as they defined the new U.S. border. Others included local flora, and others featured the native populations, Lipan Apache, Comanche, Yuma, and Papago, the same tribes that would be captured over a half century later by the camera of Edward S. Curtis. Another early source of information about the region was the tragic memoir of the Oatman family and the Apache attack on their Mormon wagon train. The story shocked the nation, and Curtis de Visite of their captured daughter, Olive, with her Mojave chin tattoos, were reproduced in periodicals and her book. The Colorado Exploring Expedition, led by Lieutenant Joseph Christmas Ives, traveled up the Colorado River from Yuma, and the published exhibition report added images of the region and its native population. Once again, though, photography had been documenting travel images for over two decades. Artists' interpretations filtered the images that were seen in publications and shaped public awareness of the American Southwest. For example, though there are references to illustrations taken from photographs, the earliest photographs of Arizona identified to date are a group of stereographs by H.H. Egerton from 1864. He made them when a group of investors and engineers traveled to Arequipa to evaluate the possibility of reopening the mines in Arizona, as returning Civil War soldiers could help control the native population. These images document the area and include several views of the Pima and Papago scouts and warriors who likely had been involved in the Bosque Redondo deportation. The wet plate process. These and most images into the 1880s were made using the wet plate process. Each negative required a piece of glass, all of the chemistry, and even water when other sources were not available. Dark tent or wagon as a dark room, camera, tripod, plate boxes, and other miscellaneous supplies. An estimated 150 to 175 pounds of equipment was needed to make photographs in the field. The glass plate sized for the camera was coated with collodion, a syrupy mixture of gun cotton and ether. The plate was then sensitized in a solution of silver nitrate and placed in a light, tight film holder. After focusing and composing the images, the plate holder was inserted into the camera. Dark slide removed, lens uncapped, and the plate exposed. Before the collodion dried, challenging in the dry climate of Arizona and much of the West, the plate was developed with pyrogallic acid, then desensitized or fixed with potassium cyanide or sodium thiosulfate, then washed and finally dried, then packed for transport. The photographer needed to safely carry the glass negative back to the studio where the images could be printed, mounted, and sold. The equipment, tents, and wagons made the photographers highly visible and the potential target of thieves, bandits, and raiding renegades during the Indian Wars era of the mid-1880s. We can only imagine the challenges faced by the adventurers and entrepreneurs who left the safety of their studios to travel and document life in the West during this era. The Western Surveys. The number of images in Arizona and the Southwest that were available up to 1870 expanded dramatically with the geographical surveys west of the 100th meridian under Lieutenant Wheeler and geographical and geological survey of the Rocky Mountains led by John Wesley Powell. Each survey included photographers to document the regions explored, including the Grand Canyon. Famous Civil War photographers Timothy O. Sullivan and William Bell traveled with the Wheeler Party. Established Eastern landscape photographer Elias Olcott Beeman, Jr., John Jack Hillers, and James Fenimore were primary photographers for the Powell expedition. The Powell and Wheeler surveys captured public attention through the extensive woodcuts and illustrations derived from photographs that were reproduced in weekly periodicals like Harper's Weekly and Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper. In addition, both expeditions made and marketed photographs, large format images, and stereoscopic views. The images, printed from wet plate glass negatives made during the exhibition, were transported back east by train, then sold to photographic publishers and distributors. The images were so popular that the photos were quickly pirated and sold by unscrupulous individual photographers and publishers. Both Powell and Wheeler used the stereoscopic views produced during their exhibitions when they traveled back to Washington to garner support from Congress for their annual funding. Powell was able to purchase a home in Washington with his share of the proceeds from selling the stereoscopic images of his expedition. Destination Arizona. The interest in the Arizona Territory and native population fostered by the survey images drove other photographers to visit the Arizona Territory, including Dudley P. Flanders in 1874. Flanders toured the territory, visiting Prescott and Tucson, Fort Beale Springs and Bowie, and the Verde Reservation as the Tonto and Yavapai tribes were gathered at the reservation, and San Carlos as they were relocated. At San Carlos in August 1874, Flanders produced a series of portraits of the Apaches and of newly arrived agent John Clum. In the late 1870s and 80s, the single studios that had opened in Prescott and Tucson were joined by photographers operating in Globe, Flagstaff, Phoenix, and Tombstone. Some, like Camillus Sidney Fly and Henry Buman, are familiar to aficionados of Western lore. Others like J.C. Burge, Cicero Grimes, and Charles Faircheot remain more obscure. Other famous Western photographers like Carlton Watkins and Ben Wittick were also active in the Arizona Territory. Watkins, documenting the arrival of the railroad in 1880, and Wittick, the life and peoples of northeastern Arizona. These photographers added to the visual documentation of the survey images, documenting life in the growing territory, the mining and settlements, the native population as they were moved to reservations, and portraits of key figures in the native communities. Arizona and its native people continued to draw photographers and images of the Apache, Hopi, Navajo, and Yuma people were popular and sellable. The stereo views, cabinet cards, and unmounted photographs could be purchased and placed in albums. After the handheld camera fueled amateur photography, the scope and volume of photographs increased dramatically. Each photographer who went to the Southwest to make images were aware of, and likely often studied, the work of their predecessors. Technical advances in optics and emulsions made new types of images possible in terms of aesthetics, but many of the subjects were consistent over time. The pictorialist aesthetic. With few exceptions, photographers of this era typically strove to make crisp, sharply focused images. Small, collodion, wet plate negatives, like those used to produce stereo views, required less exposure than larger negatives and could be contact printed to produce highly detailed prints on albumen paper. Glass interpositives and copy negatives were produced to expedite printing larger numbers of images for resale. Credited to the influence of painting, increasing interest in handcraft in art and photography, and later a reaction to the growth of amateur handheld cameras, a new aesthetic movement, pictorialism, grew in the 1880s with a different aesthetic. Instead of sharply focused realistic images, pictorialism sought to incorporate new techniques that included images with only narrow areas in focus, surrounded by progressively softer areas of the image, and incorporating manipulation of the image by the photographer. Pictorialism was applied to virtually all subjects, but was particularly well-suited to portraits, softening blemishes and creating dramatic emotional images with sharp focus on the eyes and softer halo framing of the face and fading into the background. Edward S. Curtis. Edward S. Curtis began his photographic career in Seattle and produced typical commercial images of the era. Curtis followed the international trends of photographic style and publications and photographic salons and was influenced by leaders in the emerging pictorial style, including Alfred Stieglitz. Curtis adopted a pictorialist aesthetic for his images of Princess Angeline, also known as Kikisoblu, the daughter of Sealth, chief of the Duwamish and Suquamish of Puget Sound, circa 1896. The recognition he received for these images from the National Photographic Society and his peers in 1898 likely encouraged Curtis to further explore and emphasize this new approach. Curtis's pictorialist aesthetic initially focused on the native population of Washington Territory and the Pacific Northwest and continued through much of the studio and environmental photographic portraiture produced for his The North American Indian books and folios. In addition to the pictorialist aesthetic, Curtis adopted other photographic media of the movement, including platinum prints, orotones, and cyanotypes. Photogravures often included handwork and retouching, and other creative additions to make the photographs more artistic and dramatic, and were Curtis's favored and most frequently used format. The photogravures permitted Curtis to add pictorialist handwork and manipulations to make his artistic ethnographic images even more romantic and dramatic. In addition to following the trends of photographic style, as Curtis expanded his project to the tribes of the Southwest, he likely was exposed to and may have studied the work of his predecessors. Though his approach to ethnographic documentary photography was artistic and stylistic, his subjects mirrored the work of his predecessors. Some of Curtis's ethnographic images, particularly his portraits, show the possible influence of the work of earlier photographers. For example, Curtis's image of a Navajo blanket weaver shares the subject, content, and approach with earlier images, including the 1873 stereo view of the Navajo weaver from the Wheeler Expedition by Timothy O'Sullivan, the Native American cabinet card, portraits produced by Francis A. Hartwell, both when he worked with Henry Buman and on his own, share an intimacy and capture an interaction between subject and photographer, similar to Curtis's work. Whether Curtis also saw and was influenced by specific historic images of Arizona Native Americans is unclear, but the similarity to style raises interesting questions. Curtis and pictorialism. Curtis used soft focus lenses and artistic processes that share the pictorialist approach of Gertrude Kazebier and her portraits of the Sioux people from 1898, of which Curtis was likely aware. In pictorialist elements in Edward S. Curtis's photographic representation of American Indians, Mick Gidley hypothesizes that Curtis was well aware of pictorialist and American photo session aesthetics. Curtis's work shares elements of position and camera and subject and control lighting to add shadows and create silhouettes to enhance the dramatic and romantic impact with some of the Kazebauer's better-known images. Curtis's synthesis of the pictorial aesthetic with the Southwestern subjects in his work and images in volumes 1, 2, and 11 of his The North American Indian books and folios extended the public awareness of Native peoples with dramatic artistic portraits alluding to their past. The rich history of the 19th century ethnographic photographs that preceded Curtis's are lesser known to many viewers. These pioneer Western photographers risked their resources and safety to capture photographs of the West in its heyday. From Flanders, who explored and documented the Arizona Territory in his wagon in 1874, to the photographers like Henry Buman and George Rothrock, who both operated studios and traveled to make photographs, to C.S. Fly, who traveled with General Cook to Canyon de los Embudos to document the surrender of Geronimo. Enterprising photographers created a legacy that we treasure today. Curtis's lasting influence. The photographers like Curtis who followed as the West became settled at the turn of the 20th century interpreted and were influenced by the images of the decades that preceded them. Whether seen in person in a stereoscope or album, in print, in popular press, the 19th century photographs created a legacy of the taming of the West. Hopefully, exploring the possible relationships between the subjects and aesthetics and the ability to compare 19th century images that document the end of the era for most American Indian cultures with Curtis's artistic studies can help broaden the understanding and appreciation of the photographs that document this era of American history. Jeremy Rowe is a senior research scientist at New York University and collects, researches, and writes about historic 19th and early 20th century photographs. He is author of Arizona Stereographs, 1864 to 1920, and serves on the Daguerrean Society and National Stereoscopic Association boards. For more information, please visit vintagephoto.com. And once again, because these stories are about the photographs, I'm going to give a brief narration of a description of these photographs that are in this article. Our first article, it looks like it would have been a stereoscopic picture because on the computer screen, there's two images side by side that are very similar. What we see here are a group of men. We have one man in the center who looks like a Western cowboy. He's wearing a cowboy shirt, a cowboy hat. He's holding a rifle. And then on each side of him, to the left and to the right, it appears that he has two other men. These men are Native American men. And then there's also looks like possibly a younger man or a younger boy who's sitting on the floor in front of all of them. Caption accompanying photograph. A portrait of Apache agent John Klum within weeks of his arrival at the San Carlos Reservation was taken by traveling photographer Dudley P. Flanders in August 1874. Collection of Jeremy Rowe Vintage Photography, vintagephoto.com. Our next picture is a very, very pretty Native American girl. She has very long hair. Her face is dark as if it has some kind of makeup or possibly ink on her face. She's wearing possibly some kind of a brown sarapa or a poncho, and she is looking almost but not exactly at the camera lens. Has very beautiful dark wide eyes, and her expression looks like that of a curious expression. Her mouth is not open. Caption accompanying photograph. A head and shoulders portrait, Mosa Mojave, taken by Edward S. Curtis, photogravure circa 1903, was in the North American Indian, Volume 2, Plate Set 61. Photogravure courtesy of the Tim Peterson Family Collection. Next photograph looks like it could be a Native American. However, this Native American man, he appears to maybe be wearing 19th century Spanish uniform of some sort. He's wearing a hat. He has on his shoulders, he has those pads that have the fabric dangling down. He looks like he has two pieces of material that are crossing his chest in both directions. And there may be some kind of a weapon, but I'm not exactly sure if there is one or not. Caption accompanying photograph, the portrait of Yavapai Apache Chief Ahuchi Kama at Camp Date Creek was taken by Western Frontier photographer Carlos Gentile circa 1868. Gentile traveled extensively across Arizona Territory in the late 1860s and early 1870s, temporarily living in both Tucson and Prescott. Courtesy, Library of Congress. And our next photo is of a young woman. She is an adult, but barely an adult, and a very attractive young woman. Her hair is long. She's looking at the lens. Her hair is parted in the middle, and it looks like she has tattoo ink that is on her chin that's going vertically. She's wearing a dress that is buttoned all the way up to the neck, and the caption accompanying photograph. The three-quarter portrait of Olive Oatman, who was captured at the age of 14 by Yavapai Apaches, shows her blue Mojave cactus ink chin tattoo. The photograph was taken circa 1863 after her ransomed rescue from the Mojaves on February 28, 1856, by Benjamin F. Powelson. National Portrait Gallery, Smithsonian Institution, Washington, D.C. And then our next photograph is taken outside. We have quite a few men that are sitting around. Most of them are in the toward the front of the picture are wearing cowboy hats. They look like ordinary Western type men wearing the usual clothing that the men wore in the Western days. They're wearing hats. There is one Native American man that is among them. And then behind them, it looks like there are at least three Native American men in the background, and then one other Western looking man that's behind them that is next to a horse. Caption accompanying photograph. Geronimo posed for Camillus S. Fly with members of his tribe and General George Cook's staff during peace negotiations in Canyon de los Embudos in the Sierra Madre, 90 miles from Fort Bowie, on March 27, 1886. True West Archives. Our next picture is also outside. We have a couple of horses. Looks like we're on the side of a hill. And we have four Native American men, two horses. Caption accompanying photograph. This group portrait of Apache men, two on horseback, others seated, was taken by Edward S. Curtis. Photogravure circa 1906, published in the North American Indian, Volume 1, Plate 11, courtesy Charles Deering McCormick Library of Special Collections, Northwestern University. Our next photo, again, is outside. We have a group of men, mostly Native American men. In the background, it looks like an adobe structure. There are two chimneys in the structure, and both are, looks like there's smoke coming out of both of those chimneys. The Native American men also are joined by, it looks like, a few Caucasian men. There are at least three. And in the forefront of this picture, we have a Caucasian man who is sitting with a child in his lap, and there's a woman sitting across from them. Caption accompanying photograph. Unidentified soldiers and Anglo settlers posed with the group of Mojave Indians at Camp Mojave on the Colorado River in this photograph, printed by Alexander Gardner, and was taken by a photographer on the Kansas Pacific Railroad Survey, possibly Dr. William A. Bell, William R. Powell, or Lawrence Gardner, circa 1867, courtesy Boston Public Library. Our next image is a group of four Native Americans. It looks like these are Native American women. They're older, and they are doing some kind of artisan work. Caption accompanying photograph, a group of Navajo Indians engaged in weaving was photographed during the Wheeler Expedition near Old Fort Defiance by Timothy O'Sullivan, circa 1861, courtesy Library of Congress. The following photograph is another portrait. It is a very close-up image of a Native American woman, very beautiful. She appears to have long hair, although she has a cloth covering her head, so we can't tell for sure. And she's looking directly at the camera, and just a very passive type expression. Caption accompanying photograph. This close-up portrait of a young Papago girl is titled "A Particularly Fine-Looking Papago Girl of As Nearly Pure Blood as Can Be Found in the Region," and was taken by Edward S. Curtis, photogravure circa 1907, and published in the North American Indian, Volume 2, Plate 48, courtesy Charles Deering McCormick Library of Special Collections, Northwestern University. The next image is another portrait, a close-up of a Native American man. Very hard to see his, we just barely see his face because there's fabric, a cloth, textile type of covering that is surrounding his face. Captured accompanying photograph. A dramatic pictorialist portrait of a Sioux performer in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show is in a style similar to many Edward Curtis portraits featured in his North American Indian series. Platinum bichromate photograph by Gertrude Kazebir, circa 1898, courtesy Library of Congress. And it looks like in the next photo, we see another Native American woman who is weaving. This photo is taken from several yards behind her. We see the back of her. Her hands are up and working with the weaving. She's looking at it, but we can't tell any details about her. We can just kind of tell that it also looks like it could be towards sunset because the light is casting quite a few shadows. Caption accompanying this photograph, this portrait of a Navajo woman with a loom under a cottonwood tree was taken by Edward S. Curtis, photogravure, circa 1905, and published in the North American Indian, Volume 1, Plate 34, courtesy Charles Deering McCormick Library of Special Collections, Northwestern University. The next image is another stereoscopic photo. It is taken from the bank. We see several men that are sitting on and beside and in a boat that is floating in a possibly a river. It looks like I see a cliff that's on the other side of the water. Caption accompanying photograph. Wheeler Expedition survey crew members on one of two uprun boats, the Trilobite, captained by Timothy O'Sullivan, posed with Mojave guides, possibly including Panamonbona and Mitawara, and were photographed by O'Sullivan, 1871, courtesy Library of Congress. Another stereoscopic photo is what we have next. And again, it's taken outside. It looks like there are several Native Americans that are in this photo. Many of them are on horseback. Identified as Papago warriors and old Chief Jose Yurubo of Bobo Cuerva, Arizona, taken at Aravaca, January 1865 by H.H. Edgerton, Assistant Engineer A.M. Company, courtesy Jeremy Rowe Vintage Photography, vintagephoto.com. And this next photo, we see a lot of people who are outside. It looks like there's some kind of a, maybe even a performance that's going on, but we have a lot of men, both Anglo and Native American men, that are in this photograph. And looks like we may be at on the side of the cliffs. Caption accompanying photograph. Visitors watching Hopi priests performing the antelope snake ceremony near the dance rock at Walpi, Pueblo, Arizona, were photographed by New Mexico photographer Ben Wittick on August 21st, 1897, courtesy Library of Congress. The next image that we see here are looks like, again, we have Native American men. We have several that are lined up and they're facing each other. Caption accompanying photo. The antelope fraternity at the right and the snake fraternity facing them at the left engaged in signing prior to handling the reptiles in the snake dance at the Hopi Pueblo of Arabai. The photograph was taken by Edward S. Curtis, photogravure circa 1921, and published in the North American Indian, Volume 12, Plate 404. Courtesy Charles Deering McCormick Library of Special Collections, Northwestern University. The next image is another stereoscopic image that is of quite a few men. These look like mainly Anglo men that are sitting against a white picket fence in front of a house. Caption accompanying photograph, soldiers and scouts at Camp Beale Springs on the Beale Springs Indian Agency were photographed by Dudley P. Flanders while he was en route from San Bernardino, California to Arizona in December 1873. Collection of Jeremy Rowe Vintage Photography, vintagephoto.com. And our final photograph is it's a very dramatic photograph. It looks like it was taken in a studio. And we see the image of two Native American men. One is seated. He's holding an axe. One is standing, and he is holding a bow and arrow. And while the arrow is not cocked within the bow itself, he's holding it like he's about to shoot the bow. And from our point of view, it almost looks like he has it aimed at the gentleman that's sitting to his right. But indeed, I believe that just is because of our viewpoint of this photo. Caption accompanying photograph. This stereo view detail shows a tableau of two Apache warriors posed in the studio with bow and arrow and tomahawk. It was sold by Carlton Watkins and possibly taken by his operator printer, Bagnasco Policarpo, circa 1877. Collection of Jeremy Rowe Vintage Photography, vintagephoto.com.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.